You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments to the...
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Sarah Rose Cavanaugh. Sarah is a psychologist, professor, and associate director of the DeMar Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College. Her research focuses on the connections between emotions and quality of life, particularly how our emotion regulation strategies influence our well-being. Dr. Cavanaugh is the author of The Spark of Learning, Energizing the College Classroom with the Science of Emotion, and she has contributed to publications like The Chronicle of Higher Education and Whole Living Magazine. She has a new book. It's called Hive Mind, The New Science of Tribalism in Our Divided World. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Wow, did this book surprise me? You have somehow managed to write a book that was released at this particular time in this particular country with the word tribalism in the title, that is not only not depressing, it's actually hopeful. How?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a personality characteristic a little bit. I remember I worked in a group home where things got pretty intense, and my coworker just yelled at me, and she was like, "How are you still smiling? You can't be still smiling through this." So I think I am someone with a hopeful perspective, but I also really believe a lot of the ideas that I share in the book about some of the problem being our negative focus, and some of the problem being miring ourselves in fear, and feeling like no other time of humanity has faced such challenges. And really, when you take a wider scope, I think we've faced such challenges and overcome them.
And unlike a lot of evidence-based books, there's a lot of storytelling in here, which is also interesting given the subject matter, and you're quite a good storyteller. So the book begins with an alarm, ends with a call to action, and I guess we should start with some of the alarms. You write in the book, quote, "Human beings are so social that we can literally make ourselves sick just by observing others." And this is how the book opens, right? And I think that's a odd and fun story you could share.
Sure. Well, there are many ways in which symptoms of diseases or illnesses can spread from one human being to another without any actual physical cause. It's not super common, but we can look at the historical record and see, you know, there was a group of girls in New York who were suffering from motor tics, and they were looking for a chemical cause, they were looking for a biological cause, and at the end of the day, they think that really it was more of a panic that spread from one girl to the next. And we can see all the way back to the Salem witch trials, how thoughts can spread from one human being to another in really alarming ways. And so we have this capacity to influence each other that is so strong that that really amazingly dramatic things can happen.
And I guess the thing that is a tick off that is that we can synchronize, but not with all members of humanity, I think you say, equally, right?
Right. We have such a tendency to form in groups. And one of the, not to get too hopeful yet, but that is in some ways, one of the most amazing things about us and one of our greatest strengths is our tendency to form these collectives and to share with one another. But of course, if two different ways that can get us in trouble. One, if we're sharing with such a tight group that dissenting opinions and creativity are not allowed, there are dangers there. And also if we start turning our in-groups so intensely that we're discriminating against or excluding people who do not share our belief systems, that is another danger.
You also ran the book, quote, "This tension between our individual and communal natures is ever present in our collective consciousness." And this comes through the book a lot, right? There is this tension between, but it's as old as I and thou, I think, and older than that. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit about what the science is behind that.
Right. So we have, you know, we tend to, as our culture and kind of Western culture, we really prize our individuality. And I'm not anti-individuality at all. And I think that it's very important for the reasons that we were already starting to talk about, to have independent thought, to not just blindly adopt the opinions of the people around you and the people in your in-group, to challenge the status quo. But at the same time, I think that we don't give enough credit to the collective sides of our happiness in particular, and the good that our in-groups can do, and the good that sharing collective emotions, traditions, and other things can really reward our well-being.
One of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading the book is conversations and sometimes arguments I've gotten in with our friends at the Center for Decision Research at the Booth School of Business, where we have this partnership, because they we're really good at, there's a lot of literature on individuals. So you can study individuals. It's much harder to study groups. And, you know, I think of, Second City forms these incredible ensembles of six people. And there's very few studies on like six people who stayed together for a year, sort of synchronizing their work. And so one of the things you write in the book, quote, mirroring is one of the biological underpinnings of our ultra sociality. And I thought about that in a comedy context, because so much comedy comes from simple recognition. The audience is, you know, looking at stage and going, oh, my dad does that. And it like, you're not even saying a joke. There's nothing. It is the recognition that gets the laugh.
Like Seinfeld. All of Seinfeld.
Yeah. There's like very few jokes.
Yeah.
So I'm curious in that idea, and I'll tie it again to a thing in comedy or improvisation in particular, because you quote psychologist Michael Tomasello, who says, quote, "Human thinking is individual improvisation enmeshed in a sociocultural matrix." And I guess that's sort of saying this duality is always at work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that when we can maximize both sides of that duality is really when we achieve our full potential, as individuals and as groups and as whole societies. And I think what you're saying about groups working together, I find it so fascinating. And psychology is a field trying to be better about studying people in groups.
Mm-hmm.
And because we tend to take one person and we stick them in a lab, or we stick them in an fMRI scanner, and we study them. And really, I interviewed for the book social neuroscientist Jim Cohn, and he has a whole social baseline theory that our brains and our bodies expect us to be embedded in social groups, and that actually when you take people out of those social groups, you're introducing artificiality to the whole thing, and you're not really studying human beings in their natural context. And so he studies people in dyads and twosomes, puts one in the scanner and one outside the scanner, and has them interact. And more and more psychology and neuroscientists are looking at neural synchronization between people's brains, using like EEG caps in social settings, trying to understand how, when we get together as a group of people, do we influence each other, and what is happening at the level of the brain.
So interesting. So you early in the book introduce, it's called Hive Mind, so we got to talk about bees, right? You want to talk about Dan Conlon, who's the beekeeper you talked to?
Oh, sure. So that was one of my earliest interviews. He's a friend of my brother's, and he has a beautiful set of beehives in his backyard, and kind of took his whole, he was a high school administrator, and just decided when he was something like 50-something, but he wasn't happy, and he wanted to be out in the wilderness with his bees. And so he's been spending the last 10 or 15 years selling honey around Western Massachusetts, and I sat down with him and had some really fascinating conversations about how bees do some of the things that we do, and they don't have the benefit, we don't think, of consciousness and logic and reason, but somehow they seem to synchronize and in ways that are sometimes eerily similar to the ways that we do.
Have you watched any of the impeachment hearings over the last couple of days?
I have not.
Okay. So one of the main things that kept coming up, and this I think was in the first day, and I was late to it today. I just saw some stuff on Twitter, was they kept saying all these conversations are secondhand. And you write in the book, quote, most of what we know is secondhand, is just based collective knowledge, and is often wrong. And I guess that kind of goes for everyone, right?
Right. And there is all sorts of little tricks that psychologists do in classes like cognitive psychology, like show a whole mass of pennies, you know, and have to guess which one, and no one can do it, or guess the Apple logo. And we do, we operate with little bits of knowledge that we get from other places, and we don't scrutinize the details terribly well. And if you think about any, you know, everything that we're talking about right here, I have not observed directly. I have not been in these people's brains. Most of the research I report some of my own research, but most of it's the work of others. All of history, of literature, it's stories that we tell each other.
And you talk in the book about storytelling and about reading fiction as practice, quote, practice experience. And again, that's improvisation. That is literally what you're doing is you're coming. It's funny when people ask about it because they're like, are you just making it up? And you're like, well, yes, except you're making it up with the things you know, right? So you are using the things you know, but then when you match it with what someone else knows and you sort of surrender to building a thing freely, it's really kind of remarkable and lovely and entirely pro-social. It maps quite nicely into the things that you were talking about.
Yes, I love that. And I my first book is on emotions and teaching, and I talk a little bit about improv in that. As you know, I have advocated for teachers, college level teachers, to get some acting training and to do some improvisational work in order to work on their energy level in the classroom, because teaching too is mirroring, and teaching is it is synchronizing, and you're going to be better at it if you look to the acting craft and how to influence people and how to get an audience excited about a concept.
Well, especially because you have these studies now where they show a teacher for 10 seconds teaching with the sound off and everyone agrees with like have the quality of their teaching.
Yep.
That is terribly depressing and kind of funny.
Well, except that you can do something about it.
Yeah.
I think with some training.
Yeah, use your hands. Smile more, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It was in this section of the book, and I've really poured over this because we created a improvisation for caregivers program. And you talk about Sarah Blaffer, is it Hardy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, an anthropologist and primatologist. And I want you to talk a bit about this. I think this is a profound, and this is where you get hopeful. I think it's this idea of our basis in caregiving, is that that's how we came together as a society to work together human to human.
Right. And I think, I hope I'm not going to get my publisher angry, but I didn't want tribalism to be in the subtitle of the book, because actually one of the things that I do in the book is challenge this idea that we are so tribal. Like, I think the word tribal, some people have sensitivity context to it also, but we assume that we're destined to form groups that hate each other, that are going to go to war with each other, and that that this is a deep part of our evolutionary heritage. And there is some evidence for that, but and I'm not an anthropologist, so I hope I was overstepping in this part of the book, but this Sarah Hardy and that neuroscientist Jim Cohn, another evolutionary biologist I talked to, Kim Russell, lots of the people that I was talking to really saw more evolutionary history being in this caregiving, as you're saying, evolving out of the fact that we started raising our children in groups rather than one by one, and that a lot of the social glue came, and a lot of it came from the women and the grandmothers taking care of each other, and that there's not as clear-cut evidence that there are evolutionary histories, one of a lot of warfare and a lot of violence. And so I try to reframe the idea that we're more hivish than we are tribal, perhaps, and that we do form these tight in-groups, but we can maybe do that and benefit from all of the positives of that without necessarily having all of the negatives of that.
Yeah, and it's also akin to this idea. Nick Epley up at University of Chicago once told me that if I want to make myself feel better, do something nice for someone else.
Yes. Yep.
Right. I mean, so and that's speaking to the same sort of fountain that maybe and I know. I mean, I get why the publisher wanted tribal in the title, and right? You've got to sell some books.
But also,
what a great thing, like, because you do walk in like, yeah, I want to know about this. And then you have a message that maybe is counter to this noise that we're living in right now.
Right.
And you talk a lot about fear in the book. And we talk about that on the podcast all the time, because one thing we know about, you cannot improvise well out of fear. If you're in your fear brain, you cannot. And that is what we are facing, that sort of fear noise every day.
Right. And it shuts everything down. And we know this from lots and lots of research, behavioral research, neuroscientific research, that emotions, negative emotions in general, but particularly fear, results in narrowing your attention, narrowing what you're willing to try, narrowing everything. It shuts down everything so that you can focus on this threat. And there are threats in the world. I'm not hopefully too naive, but if we're just constantly in fear, we're never going to mount a challenge to those threats, because fear is going to narrow us, and where we need to be broadened, and we need to be creative and playful.
So a lot of the book also covers what happens when we take our humanity online in these various social media settings. And there are issues there. And you write in the book, quote, what you do online matters. And you also say social media doesn't just build us up, it also takes us down. So let's start there. Let's talk about a little bit about what the dangers are in terms of the online world. And then you can also talk about the fact that this isn't a book that's like hateful on smartphones.
Right. So I feel like the predominant narrative about both smartphones and social media are that they're really dangerous. And, you know, I wrote a piece for Literary Hub recently on this, and I looked around at some of the negative articles, and they're not just portrayed as dangerous, but having to do with the devil and having to do with horror, and our feelings about these technologies are so negative, and again, fearful. And so the negatives are certainly there, and, you know, cyberbullying campaigns, especially against women and women of color on places like Twitter, you know, children bullying each other online, you know, trolls. There's a lot of really great work done by Jay Van Bavel and others on moral outrage in social media, again, especially on Twitter, and how that moral outrage just spreads faster and more furiously than other emotions and other content. There's definitely negatives. And I think also, you know, people, I would quote myself as a moderate in this, in the whole evaluation of smartphones and social media. But I don't think that everyone should be peering at their phone 24 hours a day, and that if you're not, you know, if you're not getting enough sleep and you're not getting enough exercise and you're doing, you're cutting back on all of these really healthy activities, that isn't going to have downsides. It certainly will have downsides. But at the same time, the data are not lining up to support the idea that that these are dangerous tools. What really seems to matter is context, who you are, how you use it. If you're using social media, whether you're an active user who's engaging and commenting and sharing, or you're lurking, And so and there are certainly some people who are going to be more vulnerable to the ill effects than the good effects. And I think that we need to take care to evaluate what underlies vulnerability and what are the ways that we can protect the more vulnerable. But I think that like anything else in life, there are positives and negatives, and probably moderation is going to be our way through.
I did think this is something I didn't realize was a thing, and use the term, quote, fusion paranoia. But this idea that these various fringe groups that didn't have a place to, like, meet each other, this is now a place where they can meet each other.
Yes, that is definitely the most alarming thing for me. And I especially as currently we really don't have the support of the major platforms. And so what I mean by that is that, as you're saying, all of these kind of conspiracy theories are spreading, and they're spreading kind of virally and recruiting people as they go, snowballing, and different groups that didn't used to talk to each other as much, like anti-feminist groups and racist groups and white nationalist groups, are, as you say, fusing. And what we really need, I think, to have any hope of countering that effect and the larger atmosphere of disinformation is the cooperation and work of, you know, YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. You know, we can try to nudge people into more pro-social behavior one by one or encourage that. But what we really need is changes to how these platforms operate.
100%. And it's interesting to, on that topic a little bit, you know, we have these fringe groups now, but I was really fascinated by Kelly Baker's work and research on the KKK. And just thinking that this stat was wild. Like in 1924, they had 4 million members.
It's nauseating.
It's and also I thought it was interesting in the book how it's like, if we just paint these all as like hillbillies, like that is misunderstanding the real threat.
Right. And I love Kelly's thoughts about, you know, she says that that allows, if we use the KKK as what racism is, that allows so many of us to not examine our own underlying assumptions and our implicit biases. And she has some wonderful quote about, you know, it allows people to say, you know, I'm not burning crosses in someone's yard, and so therefore I'm not a racist. And that can't be our metric. And that she really points to that journalism needs to change and not use, you know, she says every time they write an essay about racism, they put up an image of a KKK image.
Yeah.
And that just encourages this this tendency.
I wanted to tell you a little bit about a thing we created. We have a program called the Second Science Project, which looks at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation, Second City and the University of Chicago. And you talk about in the book about these anxiety reducing interventions, you know, and we actually studied this. So, you know, the concept of yes and is very familiar to people. And the scholars at USC said, yeah, but when you have an intractable problem between two people, how do you actually just keep them in conversation? And we went back to sort of our improv lab and we came back with them and we discovered that it's moving from yes and to thank you because. So literally in a conversation, expressing gratitude, seeing the other person, back to them, making sure your because is correct. And if they do that with you, at least you can keep talking. And that strikes me that that's kind of what you're getting at. In that particular chapter.
Right. And I think so much of it, and this is one of those, if you have a hammer, everything's a nail. I study reappraisal and which is rethinking the meaning of the situation and reframing the nature of the situation that you're in. And so that to reduce anxiety, to feel better. And but I think that there's so much evidence that that is a really powerful technique. And that sounds like sort of a group intervention of reappraisal, changing the interpretation of the situation to we're having an interchange. You've just provided me with something and I'm grateful for it. It's a beautiful reappraisal.
Yeah, and I think you, with the studies back up, our physical nearness to those who are different should help. And we seem to be living in a time where like we're blocking and we're canceling and we're doing everything we can not to be in the same room with these people.
Right. And that is really dangerous for other reasons, because it if you're never hearing different opinions, and this has been, you know, of course, talked about and written about a large amount, but, you know, not hearing challenges to your opinions and hearing people echo the same opinions back at you is both going to confirm your worldview, not stretch it at all, but then research shows that it actually makes your worldview more extreme, pushes you more to the outskirts. And so I think opening dialogues between people, and as you say, giving them the chance to be in the same room with each other and to have a conversation is really important.
All right. And your sort of mastermind plan with this book, I know, was, and then I'm going to hit them with The Greatness of Dogs at the end. And that will, for all those dog lovers, of which I am, it's like you get to this chapter, you're like, yes, the world is going to be okay because you have proven the essential goodness of dogs.
Yep.
So talk to us about Brian Hare at Duke and his research on our canine companions.
Yes. My editor, who's wonderful, I love her, she calls that my breakfast at Tiffany's chapter.
<She's>
like, we may not agree about anything the whole book, but here we can agree about dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think dogs are a whole species that we welcomed into our synchronicity and our sociality. I love Brian Hare's research, as you say, on canine cognition and how we might be very different genetically from dogs, but that we have tens of thousands of years of co-evolution with them, where we were companions. And, of course, we selectively bred dogs, too, to encourage certain traits that we appreciated about socialness and about their openness to us. And I think it's a beautiful story. I interview the lead trainer at a service dog organization, and the name of the chapter comes from this quote that she has, that she believes there's an invisible leash between the dog and the human, where they can understand each other, a channel through which they synchronize. And so I think not just human-to-human synchronize, but also human-to-dogs. And I think my favorite research, dog research, is there was a research study looking at oxytocin release, which is a neuropeptide that's involved in many things, but among them attachment and bonding. And that when dogs and their owners shared long gazes with each other, they both were releasing oxytocin and in these kind of spirals or loops. And I adore that. So they even though they're a different species, we have welcomed them into how ultra social we are.
Love it. It's so cool. So soon we're going to ask you for a yes and story, but you really end the book with some statements of belief and some affirmations, and it's a really nice way to end. And one of them, you say, quote, living for ourselves by ourselves leads to unhappiness. Unpack that a little bit more for us.
Right. So there's so much research on loneliness, and loneliness is linked to mortality, to all sorts of health problems, to mental illness. If you look at the happiness research, what people do to make themselves happier, almost anything that people do to make themselves happier actually paradoxically does not make them happier. So if they're striving more, or they're buying more, or whatnot, except spending more time with one's social others is the one kind of happiness-seeking activity that seems to really amplify happiness. If we look at work on communities, if we look even at work on people who have been through a natural disaster, a response to some crisis, and coming together and actually sharing positive emotions, there's just so many different lines of research that seem to indicate that one of the critical components of human happiness is the extent to which you feel embedded in an in-group that understands you, that sees you. And the loneliness research is really clear. It's not, are there people around you? So people can be incredibly, they can be married with children and friends and be incredibly lonely. Are there people around you who get you, who understand you, who see the you that you think you are? And all of that research really shows that sociality, being embedded in the community in an important in-group is critical for happiness. And I think in our culture, when we try to be happy, we tend to focus on the individual, right?
Mm-hmm.
To exercise more, to meditate more, to achieve more. And that is not going to get us where we want to be.
Yeah, yeah. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday about this. both of us kind of going through grieving processes. And we were just sort of saying this, you have a tendency to want to think you need to shut yourself off, and you really have to push yourself to connect with others and not be silent. And it's like, it's the silence that seems to get you every time. And you also talk in the book about creating room for mistakes. This is a huge thing in improvisation, of course, because what we recognize is mistakes can be actually incredible opportunities. They are going to happen regularly. And we have this very like odd thing in culture where somehow we're supposed to rub out all mistakes when it's impossible. It's an impossible thing to do.
Right. And I think also, especially when you add overtime factor, and we, you know, now that we have the internet, not just in the present moment, but we have this internet history, you know, people grow and change and develop as people, and that is something we want to encourage and something that is so important. But yet, you may be a very different person than you were 5 years ago, but your current self is sometimes held accountable for things that your older self did, which I think gets really problematic. And it's not that I think that there are not terrible things that people do and say that they need to be held accountable for, even if it's an older self. I absolutely think that's true. But I think that it's hard. Mistakes are going to happen, and especially over time, as we learn and grow as human beings, we hopefully make fewer mistakes, but we're never going to learn and grow if we don't make those mistakes.
You know, you talk in the book about abandoning this ancient story of an individual hero on a mighty quest. And I think about that because it's like that permeates our culture. The idea that there's a single person who's going to save us all, and that there's, you know, all that Steve Jobs, you know, mythology. It's like he didn't make the product. I mean, you know, like it's hilarious. But like, are we so stuck in a binary that we have to think that it's a one that's a savior when that's never been the case?
Yeah, I don't know. And I think that fairy tale, I think we get a lot of that ideology from fairy tales and from early stories. And in fairy tales, you know, kind of embed the values that the culture is trying to impart to its children. And I think that's why we have all those heroes on mighty quests. But we need something more like the Fellowship of the Ring, right?
Right.
Where it's the collective that gets it done.
Okay, we'll write those new stories. I want to see if you've got a yes and story for us, a time in your life when you normally would have said no, but instead you didn't stop at yes, you said yes and.
Yes, I think it was writing my first book, and so I had been trained as a research psychologist, and I still am a research psychologist, but I had done, you know, a lot of my job was statistics and data gathering and things like that, and I'd always been fascinated by writing, and I am a pathological reader. I read so much fiction, and I always kind of felt the call of writing, but I also loved my research. But my director of my Center for Teaching Excellence approached me. He had a new book series, and it was on pedagogical literature, but he wanted the books to be written in a really accessible, story-like way, with storytelling, as you say. And he invited me to write the book. And I think a lot of my colleagues who are in similar positions as I am would view a book as a distraction from my regular job and, you know, kind of getting grants and publishing research studies. And I was just so pulled by the idea of being able to write and write in this kind of story-like way that combine that with research so that there's still the strong research component, but also the writing and the storytelling. And so I said yes. And then I kind of changed my whole career. And now I do more, I'm still doing research partly, but I do more of it in the classroom on how we can help teachers teach, and I've been doing a lot of work in faculty development, helping teachers be better teachers, and we've done some improv at some of the conferences.
Good.
And then I wrote this book, which is a more popular book for a more general audience, and that is even a further step down the road of creative nonfiction rather than research writing. And so I think that was a pivotal moment where I could have said no, but I said yes, and I'm just going to go whole hog.
Yeah, and the results are a fantastic book. It's called Hive Mind, The New Science of Tribalism in Our Divided World. Sarah Rose Cavanaugh, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.